I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? Tomorrow, British, Irish, and Commonwealth citizens over 18 who are resident in the UK, along with UK nationals living abroad who have been on the electoral register in the UK in the past 15 years, and Commonwealth citizens in Gibraltar will vote on that referendum. It's a yes or no vote, and whichever side gets more than half of the votes cast will have won. The results should be known by Friday morning. Why is there a referendum? What are the reasons for leaving? What are the reasons for staying? And why did all of it take place right now? We have two guests with us this hour. Daniel Kellerman is a professor of political science and chair in European Union politics at Rutgers University. His most recent book is Eurolegalism, the Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union, and it won the Best Book Award from the European Union Studies Association. David Rennie is also with us, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. He joined the publication in 2007 as the European Union correspondent based in Brussels. He was on the foreign staff previously of the Daily Telegraph with postings in Sydney, Beijing, Washington, D.C., and in Brussels. Daniel, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi. Well, this has finally started to receive some attention. It wasn't getting much at all, but in the last few days, everybody's reporting on it. Why is all of this happening right now? Why is there a referendum now? Professor Kellerman, you want to start?
Well, yeah, we have to go back to 2013 when David Cameron, for basically reasons of domestic politics, promised that should his party win in the next general election, the Conservative Party, that he would hold a referendum on EU membership. And the reason he did that was sort of twofold. Within the Conservative Party, there was a real rupture between the more Eurosceptic or anti-EU wing of the party and those who supported membership in the EU more. And he thought he could sort of put off the issue and quell a rebellion from those Eurosceptic members by putting the issue off into the future, and also he thought he would never really have to do it because he didn't polls at that time didn't look like the Conservatives would get an outright majority. So it was a sort of promise in the future that he thought he wouldn't have to deal with. And then the other thing was he was dealing with the rise of this UK Independence Party, UKIP, which was campaigning on a platform of Britain leaving the EU, and they were gaining a lot of support. So it was a way to have a response, say, we'll let the voters decide.
And have the Eurosceptics always had the same list of issues as to why they, Britain should leave the European Union? Or are they different? Have they changed?
Yeah, the issues have morphed somewhat over time. And for instance, right now, immigration is a huge issue, really the top issue for the Eurosceptic camp, and that wasn't always the lead issue for them if you go back in the sort of history of that Eurosceptic movement. Some other issues have been consistent, the sort of notion of sovereignty or just that the UK should be charting its own destiny more and not part of a supranational organization. So some things have been consistent, others have changed.
David, do you expect a huge voter turnout on this referendum?
Well, in some ways, so the Economist that I work for, we are hoping that people vote to stay in, and so we are probably rooting for a big turnout. Why do we say that? Well, there are some big differences among different, say, age groups, different demographics, and one of the big groups that is strongly in favor of staying in is younger people. There's almost a kind of lockstep when you look at the polling data that every year that people get older, the more likely they are to want to leave. But the problem with young people, as we know here in America as well, is they don't always vote. And so there's a real anxiety that people won't. I think what we have at least seen the last couple of weeks, and it's kind of the only good side of a really ugly, poisonous, and recently kind of tragically violent campaign, is that people now no longer say, oh, it doesn't really matter very much and there's not very much at stake. I think everyone has woken up to the fact that it matters a lot, that it's a very angry, almost toxic debate, and that it's incredibly close. So fingers crossed people do turn out.
Mm-hmm. Understandably, people were really shaken by the violent component here. The young member of parliament who was pro-refugee, pro-immigrant who had her whole political future ahead of her and seemed like a really nice person. That must have shaken everybody up.
That's right. And to be fair, it's not possible to say that she was murdered. Jo Cox, she was a Labour MP, first-term Labour MP for a constituency up in the north of England. It's not fair to say that she was murdered because of the EU referendum campaign. And in fact, certainly conservative newspapers have stressed the fact that the man who killed her, although he did make statements about death to traitors and freedom for Britain and Britain first, and did have links to far-right white supremacist groups in Britain and in America, that he also had mental illness. He'd been extreme for a long time, and it's not fair to accuse the anti-European camp of having kind of brought about this death. Having said that, I do think it is reasonable to say that people of goodwill have been very dismayed by the turn that this referendum campaign has taken. It began with both sides promising to make a kind of positive case that Europe could work pretty well and we were doing pretty well in Europe, or on the other side that Britain free of Europe would be this kind of buccaneering, kind of nimble little kind of sailing galleon whizzing around the world trading with our partners. That isn't how we've ended up. 24 hours away from the vote, we've ended up with this horrible, toxic kind of exchange of kind of fear-mongering, really by both campaigns, but also an unbelievable focus on immigration and on things about immigration that just aren't true. So one of the single biggest arguments we've heard is that Turkey is about to join, country of 76 million people, mostly Muslim, and that somehow Britain is about to be invaded by 76 million Turks. It's not true. Turkey isn't about to join. And even if Turkey were close to joining, which it's not, every member state of the European Union gets a veto, including the UK. So we've seen a really low, nasty, nativist campaign these last couple of weeks.
Daniel, would you agree with that? Is it toxic?
Yeah, absolutely, it's toxic. And, while you can say that on both sides of the debate, there have been some misleading statistics and misleading claims, we shouldn't pretend, I think, that there's any kind of false equivalence of saying, oh, both sides have misled. Really, the lies and distortions have been heavily, one has to say, on the side of the Leave camp, where they've repeated claims, claims about Turkey, as David just said, claims about the budget contribution of the UK. They come up with this £350 million pounds a week figure that they keep touting, even though it's been thoroughly disproved time and time again. And you can go on and on. And then, also these kind of analogies, which we've seen both from Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, two leaders of the Leave campaign, comparisons of the EU with the Nazis and things like that, which has created this incredibly toxic atmosphere. And then also, there's some of the imagery used. Nigel Farage, the leader of UKIP, they came out with this poster that was modeled very closely, or if not modeled, by coincidence, closely resembled a Nazi propaganda poster showing a wave of immigrants and sort of implying that the EU was opening up Britain to waves of refugees, etc. So, yes, it's been incredibly toxic, and particularly on the side of the Leave campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, does Britain have a problem with too many immigrants coming in, not enough jobs, taking jobs away from people who live in Britain? Is there a valid concern here, David?
So here's the two giant things that have changed. And it is important to say that though it's been a dismaying and toxic campaign, it is perfectly possible to be a reasonable, mainstream, non-racist British voter and to believe strongly that you want to leave the European Union. That's not what The Economist thinks, but there are plenty of perfectly reasonable, non-bigoted people who would like to leave the European Union. I mean, the European Union, in many ways, the British have always been awkward members and have not always shared, a lot of the ambitions of other members to have, a European army or much more kind of political integration. So that point's worth making. Why have we ended up talking about immigration so much right now? Well, the big thing that has changed in terms of general public opinion is that Europe has become essentially conflated with immigration. And why that really happened is that the final act of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Soviet bloc, was a whole swathe of Eastern European countries, Poland, the Czech Republic, Latvia, Estonia, all of those countries, came into the European Union in a very short space of time. And once they became members, their people could travel freely across the European Union. There was then the question about whether they got to work legally on day one or whether they could just come as visitors freely. And Britain was the only large country that gave them the right to work freely and legally on day one. And that was a decision taken by Tony Blair's Labour government back in the 2000s. Now, The Economist, we would still say that that was the smart, correct, and also compassionate decision. But it was also smart, because if you think about the kind of polls that we got in the UK, we got 500,000, but they tended to be the best educated, they tended to have the best qualifications, because it's logical. They're not going to work in the black market when people with a university degree can get a legal job. So that was the smart thing to do. But the real disaster was that, having taken that decision, the numbers were much, much larger than the British government of the day was expecting. They didn't expect 500,000 people to arrive in a short space of time. And they essentially kept quiet. They didn't say to British voters, you know what, you're right if, to your surprise, there are now lots of foreigners in your high street or working in your local businesses. And we chose that to happen because we think it'll be good for the economy. They're choosing to come and pay their taxes in the UK.
Right.
That's a win for the UK. So by staying silent, they kind of left the terrain open for a lot of anxiety and for a lot of fear-mongering. And that really has been the big, big driver of public opinion the last few years.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, have those people been good for the economy?
Well, yeah, the EU workers who've come to the UK have overwhelmingly been a positive force for the economy, because if you just think about it for a second, who's coming, right? It's young people coming to work. Young people, you know, don't take pension payments, they don't use the national health as much, et cetera. They're overwhelmingly young, healthy workers who are, as David said, working in legal, legitimate jobs because they have that right to work, and so they're paying taxes. So they're, for the fiscal position of the UK, they've been a huge net benefit. I mean, so that's the EU migrants. I think another point to make, though, is that EU migrants into the UK represent less than half the migration into the UK in recent years. You know, the other migrants are coming from the rest of the world more generally, and that is a migration that's controlled, again, by the British government, and not sort of forced upon them, you know, by the EU. So, you know, it's been British government policies have largely influenced, you know, the rate of migration, and yet it sort of gets framed as it's all in the hands of the EU.
Mm-hmm.
And the one other thing I would say, you know, keep in mind that, you know, EU workers, you know, they don't have a right to just show up and claim welfare payments or something like that from day one, which is, again, what the critics often try to frame it that way. You know, they have the right to come as workers and seek work. And, yes, then as workers, you know, they may qualify for benefits then. But, you know, it's not like you have people just lining up for welfare payments from all the other EU countries.
Mm-hmm. What have been the problems of the European Union? First, let's talk about what the grand goals were when it was started, why it was started, when it was started, how it has been successful, and if we can talk mostly about the benefits to the UK, because that's where the referendum is, and where the problem areas have been. Could you start, Professor Hellman?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. And, of course, if you go back to the beginning, the UK wasn't a member originally. It chose not to join when the European Economic Community was formed in 57, or if you want to go back further to the Coal and Steel Community, which was the forerunner. But yeah, basically, if we go back to those early years, the European Economic Community was a project of economic integration, but that had broader goals of bringing peace and stability to Europe in mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the founders were using the vehicle of everyone's economic interest and appealing to countries' economic interests as a way to get them to cooperate and collaborate on these economic projects, with the idea that that would make them, you know, more peaceful and safer partners going forward. And you have to say that in the big picture of the 60-year development of the EU, if we put off for a second, which we can come back to, the crisis of the euro and now the crisis of migration in the last few years, but if we let's say, run up to, let's say, 2008, and look at that time span, the EU is enormously successful in the sense that Europe has had its greatest period of prosperity and peace, you know, in basically in all of European history, and the EU has enlarged from 6 now all the way up to 28 member states. So the project was very successful in broad terms. Now, in the last few years, there's been a lot of problems, as you highlighted. The euro has been in crisis, and that's a whole other topic we can open up now.
Mm-hmm.
And then more recently, over the past year, with the flood of refugees from the Middle East and Africa, the system of open borders, the so-called Schengen area, is also in crisis.
Mm-hmm. And plus we had that whole, David, remind us of what happened with the debt standoff with Greece.
That's right. Although Britain was in some ways insulated from a lot of the kind of direct pain of the Greek crisis, because as a non-member of the euro, remember Britain still uses pounds and pence, not mm-hmm. the euro, they didn't have to pay very much into to the bailouts for Greece. So that's been more of a kind of cautionary tale than a direct source of kind of financial burden to the UK. But the big thing that happened with the financial crisis is the big shock for public opinion has been the sort of conflation of immigration with Europe and open borders, and also an element of globalization. A lot of the stuff we see with, say, Trump voters basically seeking a scapegoat for the idea that the job for life that you used to be able to get in a factory no longer seems to be available.
And right.
In a lot of rich Western countries, people are looking for scapegoats for that kind of big change. But specifically at the level of the elite, say members of parliament from the Conservative Party, some big business bosses, those people were always quite irritated by some of the European Union's sort of ambitions. They didn't really like the idea of joining a deeper political union. They were very hostile to the idea of a single European army. At the kind of important but sort of gut emotional level, the British don't look at the European flag and kind of feel, stirring in their heart that this is their flag. They don't listen to the European national anthem and think that's their anthem. So why does the economic crisis feed into that? Well, because if you were a Conservative member of Parliament or a big businessman, you said, well, I may not like the European Union very much. We joined kind of grudgingly because the continent's economies looked more dynamic than our own. And so we joined this club reluctantly in the 1970s, late, as the professor said, years after it had been founded on other people's rules, basically because, 1970s Britain was an economic basket case. And if listeners have ever seen the kind of cars that British car plants produced in the 1970s, it was basically a very unhappy country with a lot of strikes, bad labor relations. We made bad things. We were kind of gray and drab and sort of out of ideas. So joining Europe was a way of getting some economic dynamism, but we did it reluctantly. Once the economic crisis really bit, and particularly the euro looked like a kind of real mistake, then you were sort of thinking, well, I'm in this club I never really liked mm-hmm. because we thought it was economically dynamic. And now the continent looks like the economic basket case. So what are we still doing there? So that's been the big shift at the level of kind of members of parliament who are willing to take quite a lot of stuff that irritated them in exchange for access to the single market, to that free trade zone. And now they think, well, maybe that free trade zone isn't worth that much. Now, just to end quickly, we at The Economist think that that calculation is profoundly wrong. We think that for all of its flaws and for all of its kind of woes at the moment, being outside the single market would make us much poorer, would make it much harder to attract foreign companies to invest in the UK. So we still think the single market is worth a lot, but the idea has spread that it's not.
We're talking about the referendum that will be voted on tomorrow. Results should be known on Friday. The toxic campaign that has ensued with this question, should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? Our guests are David Rennie, who was just speaking, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, Professor Daniel Kellerman, Professor of Political Science and Chair of European Union Politics at Rutgers University. Our phone number, lines are open for you right now. I know we have some expats living in Wisconsin who we hear from every now and then. I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is @KDunnShow. And we've been hearing for a long time now that markets all over the world are pretty jittery about the vote here. We'll talk about the ramifications for the financial market all over the world and why it is that our president is in favor of Britain remaining a part of the European Union. Much more to discuss ahead, including phone calls from you. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls coming in. Bernie in Whitewater, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm a progressive who disagrees with both of your guests. I've learned, oddly enough, about this from Paul Craig Roberts, who has been interviewed extensively on the subject. He was an assistant secretary of the Treasury under Reagan. And the main points are these. The European Union is a lot easier for our government to control than 28 separate countries. And the control is focused on two things. One is economic. The European Central Bank is controlled by former Goldman Sachs executives. They run the bank. You can see they weren't too good for the Greek people. That economic control through one place, one point of contact, as opposed to 28 separate ones, is incredibly important. The other is militarily. NATO has been very aggressive with respect to the Soviet Union. Our government overthrew the government of Ukraine. Washington, D.C., under Democrats and Republicans, has been aggressive toward Russia for many years. It's critically important for world peace that that stop. The only way that will stop is for countries to leave the European Union. So for peace and for the economic prosperity of those countries, they need to get out. But the government of the UK has spent £9 million on a glossy leaflet trying to persuade people to stay. Obama and Goldman Sachs and the military-industrial complex want people to stay. And lastly, declassified documents show that the CIA created the European Union with the expressed intention of making it easier for them to control what happened in Europe. That was printed in the Telegraph back in 2000.
All right, Bernie, thanks for the call. David, let's start with you.
There's a mixture of stuff that's not right and some conspiracy theories in there, but which I'm not going to engage with. I mean, a lot of that was just not true. What is true is that America has always been keen on the European Union, and it is true at the beginning of the process in the Cold War framework. America was looking to shore up Western Europe against the threat of communism. That's correct. But America, I mean, really isn't the kind of the hand behind the throne here. And I think it's interesting to kind of try and drag us to the world, to the planet that we actually live on. It was interesting that when Barack Obama visited the UK most recently and made this big intervention that David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, essentially wanted him to make, which was to say, you know, actually, when people say that leaving the European Union would improve relations between Britain and America and Britain would be able to sign this fantastic new trade deal with America, Barack Obama went out of his way at a press conference in London to say that's not true, that America is actually trying to forge a new free trade deal with the whole European Union at the moment, that in terms of kind of spending political energy, time, and capital on new trade deals, really doing them one by one with individual countries is not where America is right now. And he had this phrase that if Britain did that, it would be at the back of the queue. And what was interesting, if you sort of see America as a kind of master plan, sort of secret hand behind everything that happens, is that actually there was a backlash in the UK. And on balance, people sort of said, oh, you know, Barack Obama shouldn't be trying to bully us, shouldn't be trying to tell us what to do. Personally, I think Barack Obama was saying something that's clearly self-evidently true, and it's another reason if you support free trade, which I suspect that our caller doesn't, if you support free trade like The Economist does, one reason to fear Brexit, Britain leaving, is that this idea that we'll go around the world signing up new free trade deals just mistakes the politics of the moment. There is no appetite that I can see in Congress or in really any big Western democracy at the moment for a big, ambitious new free trade deal. So I think that the idea that Britain would be able to immediately get kind of tariff-free access for British goods around Europe is a mistake.
What do you think, Daniel, would be the economic implications of a British exit?
Oh, well, there are many. So, and this isn't just my opinion, basically every reputable economist and international economic organizations that have looked at this have come to similar conclusions, although the estimates, you know, do vary. But you know, the UK would probably, in the short term, be hit by a recession from a combination of factors, including big decreases in foreign investment into the UK, you know, the pound will take a hit, there'll be instability on the markets, et cetera. But to be honest, part of the reason we can't make very firm predictions about the economic repercussions is that while the referendum is on whether the UK leaves the EU or not, the referendum itself doesn't spell out what the new relationship between the UK and the EU would be, right? So, for instance, one option would be that the UK retains access to the EU's single market by becoming, say, a member of the European Economic Area. That's the sometimes called the Norwegian model, the kind of relationship Norway has with the EU, or by sort of bilaterally negotiating trade arrangements with the EU the way Switzerland has. So, point being, if the UK retains access to the single market, right, which is where 44% of British exports go, right, then the economic hit wouldn't be as big. But, you know, one of the stickling points here is that to get that access, the EU is going to make the UK, just as it makes Norway, for instance, abide by all the same EU regulations that all members of the single market have to abide by, and also to contribute to the EU budget and to open itself up to free movement of labor. And those are all things that the Leave campaign says it wants to get rid of,
right?
Which has then led some people to suggest, well, maybe really what we need to do is leave the single market entirely. And now if they go down that path, well, then the economic repercussions for the UK could really be disastrous.
Mm-hmm. And all of this, I've read, could take years to negotiate. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the procedure for leaving the EU, and by the way, this is something, just to preface it by saying, this is something that makes the EU not, you know, a super state, and it's the kind of answer to all these questions of, has the EU eclipsed British sovereignty? No, it hasn't, because the EU allows any member to leave, right? And that's, you know, why we're having a referendum. And there's a procedure, it's called Article 50, and it calls for a two-year negotiating period where the terms of exit will be settled between the member state and the EU. So that's 2 years about exit. But in terms of negotiating any new trade relationship and other new relations with the EU, that could take even longer, several years more perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Bernie. Let's go to Jackie in Arena. Hi, Jackie.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for making the time for this. As an expat British woman, first, I don't understand why in a representative democracy there's a referendum anyway. But having gone down that crazy route, we absolutely should not only be staying in the European Union, but we should be doing what we haven't been doing for the last 40 years, which is rolling our sleeves up, getting involved. You cannot lead anything by holding your nose and saying, you guys get on with it and just leave us to ourselves. To lead, you have to engage fully and completely. I think the European currency was badly done. I thought it was a mistake at the time, but it's there. We need to deal with it. We need to engage. The British and the Germans are the two most regulatory nations in this 28-member club. Together, they could really lick this organization into shape. The problems, this program, Kathleen, your career won't last long enough for us to discuss all the problems of the EU, but running away won't fix them. We'll have an even more unstable, more uncertain, more disorganized union on the doorstep of Britain if we don't stay, roll our sleeves up, jump into the center, line up with the Germans, and fix this thing. Thanks. But apart from that, I don't care.
Thanks, Jackie. Let's give that to you. David?
So I think that you know, absolutely it's important for Britain to engage, and certainly the British media, the British newspapers have been, you know, very reluctant to admit that Britain does have a voice at the table. There's certainly an element of, there's a kind of weird lack of logic to the Leave position, which is that at the moment, as members of this club, we're completely and utterly powerless and get bullied all the time, and we're kind of subjected to the jackboot of tyranny, but that if we leave from the outside, we'd suddenly become all-powerful and the other 27 would jump to our cheek and do exactly what we want. And that's hard to kind of follow in terms of logic. I think it is, again, you know, and we do want to say at The Economist, I worked for 5 years in Brussels covering the European Union, and if you are a sort of free-trading Anglo-Saxon free-market liberal like me, it can be a very frustrating place, and there are different views there. And, you know, in some ways there are two giant camps. One is, you know, led by the French, who would tend to side with people in the south of Europe. They would tend to be more protectionist, more suspicious of globalization, keener on sort of state intervention and a lot of kind of meddling in the economy. Then you have another camp, which is much more kind of free market, much more globally minded. So that would be the British and the Swedes and the Danes and the Dutch and countries like that. Germany has always been the most powerful country, but also a swing voter. The Germans don't want to have to choose definitively between either one of those two visions. They like having the British and the French camps arguing for kind of more global competition and more kind of internal protection, and then the Germans get to kind of be the swing voter between those two groups. The irony of wanting to leave right now is that 15, 20, 25 years ago, Europe looked much more like a kind of French vision, heading in a direction that the British were not going to like. Now, frankly, things look a lot more like the British were looking for. I mean, one of the tragedies of the British debate about, you know, getting so cross about Poles arriving and doing jobs in the UK is that it was the British governments of the day that pushed for those ex-communist countries to be allowed in, pushed for a big kind of wide and shallow European Union, when countries like France and their allies wanted really to keep the ex-communist countries out, to have a smaller, deeper European Union. So Britain won a lot of those battles, and today's European Union, for all its flaws, is a lot closer to what the British governments of, you know, a generation's worth of governments have been pushing for, and it's at this moment that we're preparing to leave. But there have been legitimate frustrations, and Britain is genuinely an uncomfortable, awkward member, and always has been.
Mm-hmm. What would happen to the political parties as a result of an exit? I'm wondering what will happen to Cameron either way on this vote. But I have read that there is a possibility if Britain decides to leave the European Union, it sort of gives a boost to the anti-immigrant far-right parties that Europe is already experiencing. Daniel?
Well, yeah, so as I mentioned at the beginning, when Cameron called for this referendum in the first place, part of why he did that was that it might help heal this rift within the Conservative Party, between the Eurosceptic wing and a wing more supportive of EU membership. Now, it patently has failed in healing that rift, and you can see that by the fact that his old schoolmate from Eton and former friend Boris Johnson, former mayor of London, has come out in favor of leave, right, or in favor of Brexit, and has been leading that campaign. And really, he's done that, many observers would say, despite his claims to the contrary, he's done that partly in the hope that after winning a referendum for leave, then Cameron would be pushed out of office and Boris Johnson could himself vie for 10 Downing Street. So I think certainly the Eurosceptic wing within the Conservative Party is not going away whichever way the referendum goes. But if the vote is for leave, I would expect Cameron not to last long in office and we would see a new government with figures like Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, you know, at the helm.
Mm-hmm. You agree with that, David?
I don't know that Boris Johnson would necessarily end up as Prime Minister. We have a strange tradition in Britain that the politician who wields the knife and stabs their leader in the back then tends not to get the top job. You're kind of punished for wielding the knife. But we do have this very odd system in the UK. Of course, we don't have a presidential system. So if the Conservative Party, which currently has a majority in the House of Commons, if they change leader, then overnight that leader is the new Prime Minister without having to have an election at least straight away. So it is entirely possible, even likely, I think, that if tomorrow night the result is that Britain is going to leave, it's very hard to see how David Cameron survives as Prime Minister for very long or even, you know, doesn't have to go almost immediately. It has been extraordinary. I mean, I occasionally listen to the British radio on the internet because I'm becoming fairly obsessive about what my country does at the moment.
I'm sure.
And I can't stress how odd it is that, you know, as an intellectual fact, I've known for a time that the British government gave individual ministers the right to campaign on either side of the referendum. But when you turn on the BBC and you hear cabinet secretaries from David Cameron's own government saying on the radio, well, the Prime Minister is lying to British people, he's trying to frighten the British people, this is disgraceful, this is outrageous. And these are his own colleagues from his own party sitting at his own cabinet table. I mean, it's really very hard to remember something like this. The only thing I would correct about the professor's take on the Eurosceptics versus not Eurosceptics in the Conservative Party, really, there are only Eurosceptics in the Conservative Party. Hmm. It's just whether they want to leave the European Union or not. But even David Cameron is profoundly irritated by the European Union and, you know, would love to have a looser, less kind of bossy European Union to deal with. But he's just a realist and a pragmatist. I think that the real tragedy of this debate is that a lot of this comes down to David Cameron's kind of character as a gambling man. He was under a lot of pressure, as the professor correctly said, because his MPs were panicking on the doorstep that this was kind of killing them on the doorstep. Why do you not have a referendum when the anti-immigration party UKIP does? But there's also something about David Cameron's character that we've seen time and time again, which is if you push him into a corner and he feels like all is lost, he will always roll the dice. He will always just kind of take a gigantic risk and hope that it comes out okay the next morning. And we're in an incredible moment. If he wins his referendum tomorrow, then he will kind of bumble along and the party will be very badly divided and who knows how long he will last as Prime Minister. But if he loses tomorrow night, then you start pulling open the question of, does the United Kingdom survive? Does Scotland want to have another vote on independence?
Yes.
You know, so he could go down in history as one of the most destructive prime ministers in modern history. He could go down as a man who fell out of the European Union by accident and then divided the United Kingdom and led to its dismemberment, which is absolutely not what he wants to do. So it's an extraordinary sort of gamble that we've ended up with at his choice.
What do you think of that, Daniel?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you know, Scotland recently held a referendum on its continued...
Yeah, I watched that.
Yeah, membership, if you want to call it that, or in the UK, or a referendum on independence. And the leadership of the Scottish National Party has made it very clear that if the overall vote is to leave in the UK, but the majority within Scotland of Scottish voters is to remain, then they will push for a second referendum on Scottish independence, right? And that will give them the perfect excuse they need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And all the polling shows that there's strong majority for remaining in the EU among Scottish voters. So that's a very real possibility, as David said, that you know, we may end up, if this does go with a vote for leave, with the eventual... dismemberment of the UK. So then I guess UKIP will need a new name, UK Independence Party.
I guess so. All right, let's pause for just a moment and return and take more phone calls. We're talking about the referendum in the UK tomorrow, whether or not to leave the European Union, and the reason for the vote taking place tomorrow, the consequences of whichever action, whichever vote wins tomorrow. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guests are Professor Daniel Kellerman, Professor of Political Science and Chair in European Union Politics at Rutgers University, author of Eurolegalism, The Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. He worked in Brussels for a number of years covering the European Union as a correspondent, and he also has been on the foreign staff of the Daily Telegraph and has worked all over the world. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, more phone calls. Gary in Merrill is next. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hello. Well, it's my great hope and prediction that Britain will exit, and then after Britain will come Poland, and all those other countries that for all those decades had to live under the boot of the Soviet Union, and now for a little over 20 years they've been free and they're building up the economies, and then Angela Merkel and her group there in Brussels, they're coming down and say, hey, there's no way you people are going to enjoy your freedom over the last 20 years. We, over the next few decades, we are going to bring in 300-400 million people from the Middle East and Africa and destroy the European civilization. So get used to it.
David, take that on.
Blimey, where do I start? So Angela Merkel gets to set numbers of refugees into Germany. She's the German chancellor. She doesn't get to tell other European countries how many refugees they can take. She doesn't get to tell Poland or the UK how many refugees they can take. The Poles did emerge from Soviet domination into the European Union. Most Poles, I think, are pretty happy to be in the European Union. They don't see it as an equivalent domination to the Soviet Union. I think that, where I can engage with something the caller is kind of asking about is this sense of whether this new refugee crisis from the Middle East, this idea of open borders, how is that kind of working out democratically in this world, which is much more mobile than we have been used to. It's clearly a gigantic challenge for the European Union, and part of that is just geography. I mean, look at the debate here in the U.S., which is an ocean away from the refugee crisis in the Middle East, and it's already kind of ferocious enough. You know, when the president here suggests taking a few tens of thousands of refugees from the Middle East, that causes a massive backlash. People like Donald Trump jump on it. Remember that Germany is looking at taking 1 million people from the Middle East. It's an absolutely gigantic, stunning number, and one reason for that is that you can walk from the Middle East to Western Europe if you can get through enough countries. And so that has been very shocking. I think that would be happening even if we didn't have the European Union, and I would certainly say that getting back to the British vote tomorrow night that we're kind of talking about, even if Britain leaves, I think one of the things that people have not thought through is that if their top issue is panicking about, say, Syrian refugees turning up on the British border or trying to walk through the Channel Tunnel or trying to hitch a ride on a lorry across a ferry across the English Channel, leaving the European Union doesn't make that magically go away. You know, they will still be crossing through Europe, and the Europe of the EU will still be 23 miles away from the British coast. Another fascinating detail, not just Scotland, is Northern Ireland.
Yes.
Remember the island of Ireland?
Right.
The north of it, part of the United Kingdom, under British rule, that would not be part of the European Union. But the south of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, would be still a member of the European Union. So suddenly that border, which now, after the peace process and the end of kind of active Irish terrorism, that border has basically disappeared. You can't see it. People go either side to shop and work and live and play. Would that come back? We don't know, because suddenly that could be an external frontier of the European Union. Could you see refugees turning up in the Republic of Ireland and trying to get into the UK that way? These are all very open questions.
Mm-hmm. What about the configuration of the European Union without Britain, Professor Kellerman? Does somebody take over? Is somebody dominant? Is there a grab for, I don't know, another market? Other people will enter the European Union? What does it do to the whole European Union, the other countries in it?
Before I answer that, can I just say one thing about the last issue, too, if you don't
mind?
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, just, you know, firstly, on the caller's point, I would say Poland, back in, I think it was 1991, signed the UN 1951 Convention on Refugees. So in terms of, you know, and that's true for other countries, you know, post-communist countries in the region, in terms of countries' obligations under international law of how they treat refugees, right, that's guided ultimately, in some sense, by these UN conventions, which they signed willingly as sovereign states, right, when they became independent. Now, the bigger issue, I think what the caller is getting at, is that the European Commission has proposed a scheme that would share out the refugee burden, right? Because, you know, essentially the problem is there's a real structural problem in the EU in this free movement Schengen zone, kind of the way there are structural problems in the Eurozone and the currency. There's a parallel there because both of these are systems that were built as sort of incomplete houses, if you will, right, mm-hmm. where they had some key elements there and other things were missing. So they had free movement internally, right, for the EU, borderless free movement, which Poland has benefited from and other countries in Eastern Europe, And we have, you know, hundreds of thousands, well, millions if you add them up collectively, of East Europeans who've taken advantage of that free movement and working in Europe, right? But while you have this free internal movement, okay, the EU really didn't put in place anything like a common external border. In fact, they reached an agreement on a new EU border agency today, in fact. But we can talk about that. But point being that the EU is trying to tackle this issue that they had no common external border. They didn't have a good way of sharing out the burden of refugees that were flooding in from other countries. And so what you've seen is that some of the frontline states, like Greece and Italy, are saddled with a huge burden, right? Mm-hmm. Germany, who is willing to take in a million refugees, right, saddled with a huge burden, a few other countries, where others aren't shouldering any of that burden. And then, quite rightly, countries are saying, well, if we're in this union and we want to have free movement, we have to have some understanding of how we share out the refugee burden. But I don't think the Commission's proposal will be accepted, and we won't see the EU forcing migrants or, you know, refugees on countries. Mm-hmm. But now, back to your question, just quickly. You asked, yeah, how leadership has shifted or how it would shift with the absence of the UK. Well, we've already seen a preview of that. As David was talking about, you know, the UK has really been retreating from its engagement in the EU in recent years, you know, partly as this referendum has been pending, right? And what you've seen in the absence of, you know, British assertion of leadership is an EU that's increasingly dominated by Germany, right? So if you go back to the kind of heyday of the EU in the early 90s, Maastricht Treaty, et cetera, it was often this sort of power system where it was France, the UK, and Germany as the three big powers, and when they could agree on something, it would happen, and they were kind of counterbalancing each other on different issues in different ways. Now, with the UK disengaged, with France very weak economically, and with President Hollande very unpopular, it's been a very German-dominated Europe, and that hasn't been comfortable for Germany for historic reasons, and it hasn't been popular with other countries who feel like they're being bullied around on economic issues. So I do think we need hopefully, if the British vote to stay in, we'd really benefit from a more engaged Britain who was, you know, really at the table on all the big issues. Mm-hmm.
Any sense at all of how close this is, David?
It's unbelievably close. I mean,
is
the latest polls are within a kind of point.
Whoa.
Point. And one of the problems with that sort of polling as well is that pollsters like to be able to use the most recent election that's comparable as a baseline. There isn't a baseline because the last time there was a British referendum on the European project was 1975. So, there isn't a baseline. So the pollsters are kind of guessing, really. You get very different results with phone polls versus online polls. So we just don't know. It's unbelievably close. There's a big chunk of people who still say that they are don't-knows. It's kind of 9% in some polls. And if you're an optimist and you want to stay in the European Union, you hope that those are people who basically don't want to admit to themselves that they're going to vote to stay in. But if they stay home, we just don't know. It's so close that you've got people worrying about things like there's a big famous music festival in Britain called Glastonbury, which gets a huge number of young people going to that for several days. That coincides with the referendum tomorrow, so people are worrying that there'll be too many young people at that. It's the university holidays, so perhaps that will lower the youth vote. It's got down to that kind of level of kind of granular concern about turnout.
Yeah, and for those people who want to listen to radio and get as involved as you both are, David, what are you listening to, the BBC or...?
So the domestic BBC, there's Radio 4, which is kind of the closest equivalent to NPR. They've got some very good programs on that. I think probably if you get BBC World, I think they'll probably have pretty much blanket coverage tomorrow. I think NPR's actually done some...
yes, they have.
...stuck up to NPR. I think Morning Edition and All Things Considered have been pretty good. It's always interesting hearing foreigners describing your own country for you. That's what I do for a living the other way, and I think NPR's done a pretty good job.
Yeah, thank you both so much for being with us. It was wonderful to meet you, and I hope you'll be on again. Daniel, thank you so much.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Great. And David, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Our guests, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, and Professor Daniel Kellerman, who's a professor of political science and chair in European Union politics at Rutgers University. So you're wondering when there will be results. The polls are, I can never remember if they're 6 or 7 hours ahead of us, but they open at 7 in the morning tomorrow, and then they go into their time, of course, and go until 10 o'clock, and they can't use exit polls to give announcements of where things are going. It's illegal in Great Britain to do that. So it would appear that the definitive result will be on these shores by early Friday morning. Thanks to Scotty Myers and to Chris Molina for producing this program, and thanks to Katie Matz and Cyrus for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, where the sun is still shining, no storm yet. We'll be with you again tomorrow, so thank you for being with us today.